We are back in the book of Acts. In some ways, we never really left because over the last few weeks, as you may know if you've been here, we spent a little bit of time kind of entering our little part in this grand story, just talking a little bit about Mosaic Church in particular and how we, in our way, in our cultural context, with this local community, make Jesus beautiful, how we live our lives collectively and do the kinds of things in this space as an organization and as an organism to make sure that this is about Jesus and only Jesus. Because that's ultimately the story of the entire history of the church as it should be. Whenever the church didn't make it about Jesus, it really wasn't the church, right? So the authentic church of God is the church that makes Jesus and Jesus the one exalted, beautiful, and awesome. And that's what we've been talking about. But our story is a part of this grand story that's been unfolding throughout history. And a few thousand years ago, right after Jesus had spent time on the planet and he had stepped into fulfilling the great promise of God that was given to the people of God in the Old Testament by his life, death, and resurrection, redeeming the human story and giving us the privilege of being recipients of God's grace and mercy in his great work of redemption, he then empowered the New Testament church with his spirit and sent us out on mission for him so that we might know him and make him known, so that we would bring glory to God and live our lives for that glory. That's why the authors of the New Testament write things like to live as Christ and to die as gain. My life is about Jesus now and my death is about meeting him face to face. And so this is the reality of the extraordinary life we get to live. And in the book of Acts, as we have been following this incredible unfolding story of the early New Testament church, we have been watching the gospel, the redemptive story of God, spill out from Jerusalem into Judea and Samaria, and then into the Gentile world, stretching its way to the ends of the earth. And it will, over time, because we are the recipients of it, cross incredible boundaries, geographical boundaries, generational boundaries, ethnic boundaries, language boundaries. It really won't matter what boundary the gospel encounters. The Spirit of God will move his redemption past any boundary that stands against him. And we have been watching that unfold. And a particular person that God has been uniquely using in this part of history, in the time of the book of Acts, is a man named Paul. He was bent on the destruction of the gospel, the destruction of the church of Jesus, because he was zealous for the way in which he had grown up. And so he was persecuting Christians. He encountered Jesus face to face on the road to a place called Damascus. And Jesus transformed his life and empowered him by the Spirit and sent him out not only to be a great voice among the Jewish people, but ultimately to become a great voice among the Gentile people. In many ways, the great work of God through Peter with Cornelius and then Paul to the Gentiles is why you and I sit here today, right? That is the awesome thing. It is unbelievable to see what has occurred. And most recently, as we've been traveling with Paul, we've been moving with Paul toward Jerusalem. In fact, we've been in Jerusalem with Paul because Paul is on his way to Rome so that he could go to Spain. Spain is where the gospel is expanding, or he wants it to expand. Rome is the powerhouse through which it's going to expand because Rome is expanding. And Paul wants to get to Rome so he can get to Spain so he can preach the gospel to the Gentiles. On his way, he stops in Jerusalem for a brief, momentary stay to talk with James, the head of the Jewish council there, James, the half-brother of Jesus, the head of the church in Jerusalem, and to deliver some resources he collected in Macedonia from Corinth and from Thessalonica and some of the places in Macedonia. While in Jerusalem, by prophecy from God, he is taken captive by some Jewish non-believers that have a great hatred for him and the movement. He is beaten in the streets. The Roman government steps in There is a tribune assigned to him. A tribune is like a detective of sorts who is sorting through the information so that he can make a case before the governor. The tribune engages to try to get information out of Paul. He finds out Paul is a Roman citizen. That is a crazy moment because the tribune knows you beat a Roman citizen without a trial. Giant problems for the tribune. And so he can lose his job. He can have some punitive reality, some fines that would be sent his way. So by the briefest of luck, the tribune finds out that Paul is a Roman citizen because Paul goes, "You might not want to beat me." So a gracious act on Paul's part. He could have waited and said it like after the second whip hits him, and then it would have gone very badly for the tribune. So Paul in some ways saves the tribune's neck. There he's put into prison, briefly a holding cell, taken to the Sanhedrin, which is the combination of the Sadducees and the Pharisees who make up the court of the Jewish people. And the tribune takes him there to find out what he's accused of and see if it is worthy of death or worthy of imprisonment. And that is a giant mess. And you remember as Paul leaves the tribe, Sanhedrin, and everything's going awry, and nobody can sort anything out. And every time Paul brings the gospel to bear or brings logic to bear, it just goes nowhere. And I can imagine that that must have been a fairly discouraging place. Even though Paul certainly had no doubt that God was in it, you know how it is. I know that Jesus is in this. I know that he's got this, but it's still circumstances of circumstances. And they can feel heavy. And so there he sits in prison. And where we ended last, where we pick up the story today, is a profound moment. Because Jesus once again shows up in tangible form, in his resurrected form, to Paul in prison. And he shows up with Paul, puts his hand on his shoulder, and basically says, "Dude, it's going to be okay. I got this. It's going to be okay. You have preached the gospel here, well done. You have preached it in Macedonia. You have preached it in Galatia. You have preached it all over the place. But you are going to preach it in Rome. I said it, it's going to happen." And that's where we left off. So why don't we jump in and go to where we left off, and then we can pick up the story and see what on earth happens after Jesus makes that kind of statement. I mean, honestly, I'm waiting for the Red Sea to part. I'm just saying. When Jesus shows up in a room, hand on the shoulder, "I got this. It's been a hard couple of days, but now I'm here. Now I'm here." What does it mean when Jesus shows up and says, "I'm right here. I'm right here"? Let's take a look. So we're going to be in Acts chapter 23. If you're using a smart device, we use the ESV version just in case you want to be in the same version as us. Acts chapter 23, we are going to be in verse 12. And our Bibles that we provide at the door, it's page 1033. 1033, in case you're looking for Acts and you're like, "Where is it?" It's on page 1033. All right, so Acts chapter 23, verse 12. Well, let's go to verse 11. Let's just remind ourselves of the profound moment we're sitting in right now, right? "The following night, the Lord stood by him," that is Paul, "and said, 'Take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome.'" So you catch that as a promise, right? Jesus is not saying, "Paul, try to get to Rome. Not sure how you're going to do it. You're in a pickle, but good luck." He's saying, "Take courage, my friend. My promise to get you to Rome is now declared and stands, and nothing will stop that." And so I'm like, "Oh, this is going to get pretty. This is going to be pretty." Okay, verse 12. "When it was day," so this is the next day. Paul's just had Jesus. "Hello, I'm right here. I'm with you." The very next day, Jesus rose up and wiped out the Jewish people and the Roman government and transported Paul by Tartus to, that's not what it says. It would be cool though. I'm just saying. If I were writing this thing, maybe I'd put that. But thank goodness I'm not. Here's what actually happened. "When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. I'm just saying that's not the sentence I expect after Jesus shows up. You know what I'm saying? I mean, can you hang with me here for a second? Jesus, it's going to be cool, Paul. I've got this. We're going to Rome. And the next day, the Jews were so dedicated to Paul's death that they made an oath that they would not eat nor drink until he dies. That's just not a sentence I expected. And it gets worse. It really does. So let's take a look. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. So you have to understand, when the Jewish people take an oath, I mean, this was no small thing. This was essentially them saying, either he dies or we slowly starve and die. I mean, that is what it says. When you take an oath and you go to the Sanhedrin and you say to the Sanhedrin, we have taken an oath that we will not eat nor drink until the death of Paul, you are saying to them, whether you're in this with us or not, we will find a way to kill him, because if we don't, we have to die. They are committed to their cause. And just FYI, on a side note, the things that are against us on this planet, the realities of the dark powers and forces that are against us, the realities of the flesh and sin that is around us and in us, it is unrelenting, and it doesn't care that Jesus showed up and put his hand on your shoulder. It's not going to back down. Do you understand? Like, we don't live on a planet where we are going to face things that are going to take it easy. It is immediately plot to kill. Here we go. Full-on commitment to our death. And I just think of our enemy and how many times we've said in this place, the enemy of God does not care if you are ineffective. He cares that you are dead. He's not trying to make you ineffective in your marriage. He's trying to kill it. Ineffective in your friendships. He's trying to kill it. Ineffective in your evangelism. He's trying to kill it. Ineffective in your journey with Jesus. He's trying to kill it. If he could have you and me dead, he would do it right now. And so we have an enemy that is against us. And clearly Paul here, he's like, dude, these guys, they are committed. Now watch this. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, we have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food until we have killed Paul. Now therefore you, along with a council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case more exactly, and we are ready to kill him before he comes near. I mean, are you catching this? Like, I'm just, I read these things and I just don't want to miss it. Jesus, Paul, I've got this. Next day, Jewish people with a plot to kill Paul, make an oath, go to the council and say, you bring him down here, get to the tribune, tell him, you know what, we've all settled down, we're not mad anymore, bring Paul down to the court, we'll have a nice discussion, we'll work through the case, we'll exact it out, he's probably innocent anyways, but give us a chance to discover it, and then when you bring him, as they come around, they're not going to be guarding him big time, because you're going to be so nice, and then we're going to be hiding, and then we'll slaughter him, and they won't know it was you, and you can go, oh, what happened to Paul? We're so sad. We were going to set him free. And you'll be cool, and we'll be cool, because we can eat again. It wasn't really their main motivation, but I would have had that as one. I'm just saying. So honestly, as I read that, I wonder to myself, like, how is it that Jesus shows up and says, I'm with you, we're going to Rome, and then the next paragraph is this in the Bible? And then I realize, because that's most often the next paragraph in all of our stories, isn't it? Right after we regroup and go, okay, God, I'm for you. It doesn't usually go well right after that. It usually, we hit another wall. Watch this, watch this, watch what happens. Now, the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush. So he went to Paul and entered the barracks and told Paul. Okay, I'm sorry. That is the coolest sentence in the world. Number one, Paul has a sister. I mean, how cool is that? I'm just saying, that was a cool moment for me, because Paul suddenly became a little more human to me, didn't he? I mean, they fought when they were little. I know it. I have no doubt. Have you seen Paul's personality? I mean, who wouldn't fight with Paul? And Paul fought with everyone. Even when he was sharing the gospel, he was in a fight. And so I can already tell those two, they went at it. I don't know if he had more siblings, but I know at least he has a sister. I have sisters. They fought. I'm telling you. So love my sisters, but we did fight. And so So immediately you have Paul, and he's got a sister, and she lives in Jerusalem. And Paul moved to Jerusalem because, remember, he grew up in Jerusalem because he said to the Jews in the speech before this, this is my home city. I was under Gamaliel. I served here. So his family's there. His sister's there. His sister's married. She has a husband. How do we know? Because her son is the one that discovers this whole thing. So he has a nephew. I'm so happy. I mean, I really am. Paul has a nephew and a sister, and they're in this. And so you can imagine, as they're in Jerusalem and Paul's back and he's in prison and they're keeping their eyes open and the whole thing's happening where they're like, what's going on with Paul? And this nephew, what are the chances? What are the chances that he's walking the streets of Jerusalem and he overhears about this plot? Do you think these guys are walking around Jerusalem going, we're going to kill Paul? We took an oath. We're going to kill Paul, just in case you don't know. No, they're trying to keep this thing secret. They secretly go to the council like, listen, gather up. You bring him down here. We're going to kill him. The whole thing's going to happen. How on earth does a nephew happen to hear about the plot? Jesus. That's right. Whoever said that, thank you. Jesus, with his hand on Paul's shoulder, going like this. Watch this. It's going to be awesome. I like your sister. And your nephew, they're going to be part of the story. They're going to get written into the pages of the Bible. And so the nephew's walking and he overhears this plot. I don't know how, but I think it's super cool. And so what does he do? Immediately he goes to the barracks. The barracks were open for visitation, so Paul could have visitors. It wasn't like a lockdown, solitary confinement type of deal. He was just really being guarded there. Remember also, who saved the tribune's job? Paul. So how indebted is the tribune to Paul? Very. And so the tribune's like, hey, you want your nephew in here? No problem. You want to see your sister? No problem. Nephew shows up. He goes to Paul. He says to Paul, listen, man, I just overheard some crazy stuff. I got to tell you. Look what he says. And he told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said, take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him. So I will say, for Paul, I'm going to be very curious one day when I leave this planet to go find Paul somewhere, find a fireplace, sit down with him and say, okay, I got questions. And one of the questions I'm going to have for Paul is, okay, the day after Jesus is like, I'm with you, and your nephew shows up and he's like, so there's a plot to kill you. They took an oath. There's 40 of them. They're going to get you down there and then they're going to wipe you off the planet. Like, what was going through your head? Were you discouraged? Were you like, man, Jesus, I feel you, but this is, wow, couldn't you just like have them die? I mean, not die, and Paul wouldn't want that because he wants them to know Jesus. But the reality is, or was he like, okay, let's see what Jesus is going to do here. I don't know. It doesn't tell us what Paul was feeling and thinking, but I can imagine that must have been a moment when he shows up right after Jesus, and he's like, there's a plot to kill you. And does Paul go sit down on a bench, lean back and look at his nephew and say, they're trying to kill me? You know what? Don't worry about it. Go home and tell sis it's all going to be fine. Jesus showed up last night, put his hand on my shoulder and said, we're going to Rome. So I have no doubt he'll take care of it. And I'm just going to sit here and wait it out. You know what I love most about our story with Jesus? Is that we are not only recipients of God's grace and mercy, but participants in his story. We get to be part of this thing. We get to affect the things he's given us, the resources he's given us, the gifts he's given us, the talents he's given us, the life he's given us, the circumstances he's given us, the relationships he's given us. We get to utilize those and affect those to be participants in his story. So Paul doesn't go, nephew, I see you're worried about the plot. We're going to roll out in the morning. Let's see if the guys can kill me because Jesus said I'm going to Rome. No, he says to him, you need to go and tell somebody. Who does he tell him to go tell? The tribune. Guys, don't miss what's going on here. He could have called a centurion over and said, hey, my nephew over here just said there's a plot to kill me. You need to kind of work this. It would have made sense to tell the centurion. Who did he call over when he was about to be beaten? The centurion, not the tribune. He called the centurion over. He's like, hey, are you allowed to beat me? What do you mean? Like, I'm a Roman citizen. What? Then the centurion went and got the tribune. This time he says to the centurion, take this young man to the tribune. He has something to tell the tribune. And so the centurion takes Paul's nephew over to the tribune, and let's take a look at what happens. I lost my place. I was so excited. So he took him and brought him to the tribune, verse 18, and said, Paul, the prisoner, called me and asked me to bring this young man to you as he has something to say to you. And the tribune took him by the hand and going aside, asked him privately, what is it that you have to tell me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are laying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready and waiting for your consent. So he tells them the whole story. He obviously heard every detail. I love that. So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, tell no one that you have informed me of these things. So now the tribune's kicking into gear. And he's like, okay, this is not going to go down on my watch. And he says to him, tell no one, go, I've got this, we're going to take care of this. Now, in Jerusalem at that time, just so you know, Jerusalem was a tense town because of the tensions between the Jewish people and the Roman government. And the Roman government, in each of its areas, especially the tense areas, had governors over the region, and then they had local leadership in the city, kind of like we do it here in the U.S. You've got the federal, then you've got the state, then you've got the local, and all the way down to the county and the city, and so they do exactly the same thing. And so the tribune knows that there's a sequence here, and in Jerusalem, they know that at any given time, turmoil can emerge. And the nightmare for the local government is that there would be a riot of some kind that would create a giant mess, and then it would get up to the governor, and then the governor's nightmare is that that would get back to Rome, and then the Rome would send somebody who can handle the job. You understand what I'm saying? If you can't handle the job, we'll send somebody that can. So everybody in this area was on edge as Roman officials, because what did they not want? A riot. And here's how they would get a riot. You take the Romans that are in the area, you take the Jews in the area, and you tick any one of them off. It's kind of like our political social media right now, isn't it? Just make one comment. Doesn't matter what side you pick. Have fun with it. And what are you going to get immediately? Zoom! Extremes. And there's going to be a riot online. You know what I'm saying? And that's how it was in Jerusalem at this time. Just tip the Romans and they're going to start slaughtering Jewish people. Just tip the Jewish people. They're going to start going nuts against the Romans. It would be literally war on the streets. So you know how many soldiers they had in Jerusalem at this time? They had 1,000 Roman soldiers in Jerusalem. 1,000 Roman soldiers, each of those divided into groups of 100 led by a centurion. And so the centurion was commanding over 100 of the soldiers, and they had 10 groups like that, 10 units in Jerusalem alone. They had horsemen there. They had foot soldiers there. They had spearmen there. I mean, it was a full-on legit Roman army right there in Jerusalem. Why? To make sure they kept the peace, okay? What happens next demonstrates to us a couple of things. How incredibly important it was for the tribune to make sure Paul didn't get slaughtered by a bunch of Jewish guys, tick off the Romans, and start a war in Jerusalem. Equally, how important it was for him that a Roman citizen being killed wouldn't get back to Rome and he can't do his job because he can't protect Romans from the local hooligans. You understand what I'm saying? This is the whole big thing. If you can't protect the Romans, then what are you doing? And so take a look at this. Then he called two of the centurions, this is verse 23, and said, get ready 200 soldiers. I mean, it's Paul. There's 40 Jewish guys with pitchforks, like, and he's like, get 200 soldiers with Paul. Oh, wait, that would be awesome enough, but it doesn't stop there. Take a look. With 70 horsemen. 70 horsemen! Oh, no, it's even worse. And 200 spearmen. Folks, that's like, what is that? 470 soldiers. How many soldiers in Jerusalem? 1,000. How much of the Jerusalem force did he just pull to guard Paul? Half the Romans! Soldiers in Jerusalem. He's like, get them all. I mean, I can imagine the centurion like, have you thought this through? I mean, 470 soldiers? And folks, You've watched the movies, right? Roman soldiers fought gladiators. I'm just saying, like, these weren't like, I've never been out on mission before. I'm a little scared. I mean, if a Jewish guy with 40 little of his little friends ran at a Roman garrison, they're not going to go, ah! Right? When there was a small garrison of Roman soldiers guarding the tomb of Jesus, nobody went near them. Roman soldiers were bred to move forward and kill. That's it. And so you really needed 10. No, just give Paul a centurion and he could probably take the 40 guys. And what does the tribune do? I want 200 foot soldiers. I want a boatload of horsemen, 70. Put them with him. And spearmen, give them 200. Yes, sir. We'll gather up half our stinking army for this dude. And go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. And he wrote a letter to this office. So we have the tribune now taking this very seriously and saying, you're going to take him to Caesarea, get him out of Jerusalem. The governor Felix was the governor of the region, including Jerusalem. So now you're going from local city up into the regional governments, and he's going to take him to Felix to work this out there. The reason he's going to do that, Felix would understand, is saying, this guy's a Roman citizen. There's a plot to kill him from the Jewish people. I need him out of Jerusalem. This way his accusers can come up to you, and that will force a little bit more of a difficult track for them to mess with the system and end up killing a Roman citizen. And so they assign these guys. Can you imagine Paul? Paul, come with us. We got to get out. And then, okay, you get a horse. I mean, they gave Paul a horse. Get up on the horse. Why on a horse? What's more difficult to do when you're on a horse? To kill you. That's right. That's why horsemen, they only need 70, right? A horse is a powerful animal and you've got height and you can fight. So they're like, put him on a horse, surround him by horses, surround him by spearmen, surround him by soldiers, and go. Can you imagine Paul leaving Jerusalem that night? I think the entire Roman army's going with me. I'm just saying, I feel like Jesus might have this. I feel like maybe Jesus has got this. Because now Jesus is using who? To rescue Paul. His enemies, the Romans, because they're not his enemies. Humankind is who he came to rescue. And so he is going to use the Roman government now to fulfill his plans. Jesus, when he makes a promise to us, he will use anything and everything thrown at us for his glory and his story and his kingdom. He will wait for, did Paul write this? Oh my goodness, in the book of Romans, work all things out for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. And so we're seeing it happen. Watch this. This is the letter he wrote. I love this letter. This is so awesome. It gives us such beautiful clues into the political system there. So Claudius, who is the tribune, writes, to his excellency, the governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him. Oh, it's so nice. And then I had him almost beaten. No, he left that part out of the letter. How convenient. I, the tribune, rescued a Roman citizen doing my job just as you had asked. But it's gotten a bit out of hand, having learned that he was a Roman citizen and desiring to know the charge by which they were accused, I brought him down to their council. What is the tribune doing right now? He's covering his bases. Do you see that in the letter? I've checked every box. I went through the system. I rescued him from the Jews. I took him to their council. I had them go through, and look what he found when the council did their thing. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. So he writes a letter, covers the bases, hands him off to Felix, the governor of the region in Caesarea. Paul travels up to Caesarea. It says here, so the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And so they're on their way to Caesarea. At that point, a bunch of the soldiers head back for the night, and the next day they return to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. So from there to Caesarea, the 70 horsemen ride with Paul into Caesarea, protecting him. They felt like they were far enough away that the 40 Jewish people wouldn't be able to do anything now, because they didn't even know they were leaving, because the tribune told them, "Let me think about it for the night, and I'll get back with you in the morning." In the meantime, Paul's out, right? When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from, and when he learned that he was from Sicilia, he said, "I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. So there's the story. So Paul is now in Caesarea. He's not in Rome yet. He's left Jerusalem, and he's in a holding pattern in between. For the record, Paul will end up hanging out in Caesarea for a great deal of time, years actually, before he goes to Rome. It is in Caesarea that he will write again some of those extraordinary letters that we will get to be recipients of in the New Testament. Philippians, Colossians, Ephesians, I mean, wow, some big ones, and others. We'll get to those. Then from here, he will eventually move to Rome, where he will preach the gospel to Caesar before he loses his life. What did Jesus say to Paul when he had his hand on his shoulders in the room? "Paul, take courage." I love those words. He used them also for other people in the Old Testament, people like Joshua, where he was about to go into the promised land, and before he was going to face all sorts of insane things like giants and walls and needing supernatural help from God to bring Jericho down and other stuff. And what did God say to Joshua before he went in? "Take courage, my friend. I am with you, and I've got this story." And now Jesus with Paul, "Take courage, my friend. I am with you. I got this story. When I say we're going to Rome, who can stand against you?" Nobody. We're kind of talking here, but you guys didn't realize that, so I'm giving you some space, right? I feel like I'm talking to one of my teens. Now's the time you answer me, but don't talk back, please. Sorry, side note, I'm distracted. So, listen to this. Book of Romans. Paul wrote this in the book of Romans, which he wrote prior to this circumstance. Romans chapter 8, verse 31. "What then shall we say of these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son but gave him up for us, will he not also with him graciously give us all things? Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. Who is to condemn? Jesus Christ is the one who died. More than that, he was raised. Who is it at the right hand of God who indeed is interceding for us? Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or the sword? No." And now Paul sits in a circumstance where Jesus said, "We're going to go to Rome," and everything in the world said, "No, you're not." And Jesus recruited 470 Roman soldiers for himself. There are two things that stand out to me in the life that I live that make this particular passage one I kind of want to file back and keep near and dear to my heart. One, that I need to remember that when Jesus says he's going to accomplish something, that he's going to accomplish something. When Jesus says something's going to get done, that something's going to get done. And hell itself will not be able to thwart that. When Jesus makes a promise, when God tells us that we can count on something, there are no forces that exist in all of creation that will undo what he said would be done. Amen. So if he says we're going to Rome, we go into Rome. And it doesn't matter what plots and insanities and oaths and other stuff are going to take care of. By the way, if you're wondering about the poor 40 people who are going to starve to death, if at some point the oath was impossible to fulfill, they had a way out and they could get out and eat again. It's so unfair. They should have died by starvation. Just saying. Anyways, they're going to be fine. Maybe they come to Jesus later on. The point is, that when God says something's going to get done, it's going to get done. Here's the other thing that struck me in this passage that for me personally is where I need to be right now and what I need to remember. When Jesus says, "Take courage, my friend, I've got this," doesn't mean the next day is going to be easy. You can say it loudly. Doesn't mean the next day is going to be easy. And the next day, there was a plot to kill him, and 40 people took an oath and said, "We will die before he dies," or if he doesn't die. See, the reality is we live in a societal context and a Western cultural context that says that if God is in it, then that means everything's going to get better, going to get easier, going to be okay right away. Tomorrow, wake up, take courage, be cool, it's all going to be fine. Have you tried to raise kids? You need long-haul promises from God. You know what I'm saying? Love you guys, kids, but I'm just saying, for us parents, it's like, wow. Have you tried to navigate relationships? Have you tried to deal with the realities of the paths that we take? When I look at my life, do you know how many times I look at my life and I think to myself, I don't know that we make it. Like, I don't know that it turns out okay. Like, everything's there. You may be sitting here and facing something outside the box. There may be something that you're dealing with where a disease is ravaging either your body or someone who's dear to you. You may be in a circumstance where work has become so overwhelming, and no matter what you do, you are thwarted in every way, and you're not sure what's going to happen. Or you don't have work, and you're like, what on earth is going on? We're not going to make it. You may be in a circumstance relationally with your parents or your kids, with a loved one that is just derailing. You may be in a place where you're sitting and said, "I had a dream of how this would go. I thought my marriage would look like this, and now it doesn't even exist. I thought my relationship with my kid would be this, and now it's that. I thought my relationship with my parent would be this, but now it's this." We live on a planet that is deadly and fragile and ugly and difficult and full of sin in our flesh and in the people around us, and an enemy himself who is against us. And let me tell you, the enemy who is against us, the powers and principalities, they will not rest. They do not sleep. And so we face realities, every one of us, whether in unique circumstances and big and terrible ones, or whether in just the everyday grind that is so often a space that feels overwhelming to you. Don't you feel overwhelmed some days? And you know here that Jesus is with you and for you, but do you look at the circumstances and go, "I feel like he's got this"? I'll just be honest, a lot of days I just look in my home, just inside the home, and I'm like, "He don't got this. This may have finally exceeded the power. Rome could not stand against these crazies." I said to someone earlier, "I'll put 3 of my kids against all 470 of the soldiers and they'll be on their knees in 2 flat seconds." Right? Don't you feel that way sometimes? And I have great kids. I have kids that love Jesus and are great kids. And even then, it's just this is the planet we live on. This is the life we live. And here's what God said. Here's what God said. "I will make all things new." Every one of them. Are you in a situation that seems to have come to an end and there's no redemption in sight right now, and you're like, "I hoped, but it's too late now"? I will finish every story that I began. Paul writes in Philippians, a letter he will write from Caesarea, "I am confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion on the day of Christ Jesus." Wow. He's going to finish this thing. One last thing I want to read to you, and I hope that just settles in your heart wherever you're at today, because it settles in mine. In the book of Hebrews, in chapter 11, it's writing about men and women that lived by faith and did incredible things, and they lived by faith because, according to Hebrews chapter 11, they believed God for a promise that he would send a Messiah to rescue them out of the circumstances in which they live. So the context of Romans 11 is not that they did not see the promises that God told them they would have in their everyday life. It says there was a promise God made that he would send a Messiah, and they lived and died without the Messiah coming. You with me? That's the people in Hebrews chapter 11. So it's people like Moses and Abraham and Rahab and Gideon and all these awesome people. And listen to what it says. And what more shall I say? For time would fail me if I tell you of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, and David, and Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, endured justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of the fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. So you're like, boy, when God is in it, daily promises are realized, things are done. Wait, not done yet. Some were tortured, refused to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. They were killed with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, afflicted, and mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. Okay, now listen to this. Here it is. And all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised. So now you're like, I'm sorry, you just undid your whole message. No, I'm not done yet. They did not receive what was promised in the time that they might have hoped. They had to leave planet Earth first. Look at this. Since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. What does that mean? They didn't see the promise because the timing on the promise was in a waiting space so that you and I would be recipients of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, as would they. That they would not be made perfect before we with them are made perfect. He had a better plan, a bigger plan. And if anything should remind us in this passage of anything, it should be this, that when Jesus says he's with us, he's with us. And even if the next day a plot rises against us and things don't go the way we think, and it looks like the life isn't playing out the way it should, guess what we can know? If he said you're going to Rome, you're going to Rome. And he said he would complete every good work, and he said he would redeem all things, and so he will make every circumstance that is yours today eventually be part of his grand redemptive story, so that in the hallways of eternity, when you are reading the chapter on whatever you're currently dealing with and you thought it was a broken promise, you will read it again and go, oh my goodness, I did not see the promise realized then, but I see now that his story is bigger and better than mine. So, Renaud, take courage, for I am with you, and we're going to Rome. Let's pray. God, thank you that you have promised to us that we are going to see an end to every one of our stories, as messy as they may currently be, that will be a good and right end, a redemptive end, an end where all things are made new and where you have finished every good work. Thank you that in the days in my home where I feel overwhelmed by what faces me, that I know that in me and my wife and my kids, you are at work. You will finish every good work. You will lead them. You will lead me. You will refine me and you will refine them. You will make us complete. You will finish us. And that I don't just sit on a bench and say, oh, well, watch God. I get up like Paul and say, go to the tribune and do this and strategic that and move that. And I parent my heart out and I step in and I do ministry and I preach the gospel and I participate in the story just as we all try to do in our spaces of influence. But that I do not have to fear that when it looks like my story's getting nowhere, that somehow you have left the building. For you are with us and in this. And the one who has the power to fulfill your promises without compromise, without obstacle, without fail. So God, here we stand in our circumstances, awesome or terrible, and we trust you because only you Only you are enough, and only you are more. Thank you, Jesus, for Paul's life and telling us little details that matter so much to our hearts that his nephew overheard a conversation he had no business hearing because you were in the game. You were the author of the story. You're awesome. We love you, Jesus. Amen.